Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle's weekly design show with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up on this week's show, we head to Miami to investigate the city's latest vice, Design Miami. Ahead in the show, we hit the fair and find out who's buying what from where.
If you are already a design expert or you're a design virgin, you can really discover very interesting and beautiful and compelling things.
That was reporter Sammy Mack on the stands at Design Miami with fair director Marianne Goebel. This is Marianne's first turn in the director's chair, and I spoke to her to find out what she hopes to bring to it.
I now have the privilege, after taking over after 6 years, maybe to rather concentrate on, let's say, fine-tuning rather than revolutionising things.
That was the wonderfully hoarse fair director, Marianne Goebel, on the phone the night after the opening party. And away from Miami, but still in the collector's market, I sat down with Philips de Puri's design director, Alexander Payne, to hear about their latest and greatest sale, Design Masters.
It's a year in creation. Each year we embark on creating and bringing together the world's finest pieces. It's a long journey, but it's an exciting one.
All that to come, plus a whiz around Milan gallerist Nina Yashar's favourite things, a report on the Miami Design District, a tour of our favourite second-hand stores, and a bit of a song, too. But before we head across the pond, it's time to spin the globe and catch up on the latest in this week's design happenings. Here's the news with Hazel Pfeiffer.
The city of Prague is hosting a festive design supermarket, allowing designers to sell their wares directly to customers. A kind of anti-supermarket, the five-day show features 70 international and Czech designers showcasing a range of pieces, including furniture, accessories and fashion, alongside a bookshop, cafe and installations just in time for Christmas. Stockholm Design Lab won gold in the Eurobest Advertising Awards in Lisbon last week. Their three exquisitely simple bottles for sake brand Omine Shuzu beat entries from competitors like Chivas, Johnny Walker and Kronenbourg. Boutique sake brewer CEO Takeshi Akiyama wanted a new design to overthrow conventions and challenge the traditional sake market. Lux Island Resorts last week opened the first of its luxury island properties for business on Mauritius. Offering a host of tailored services like freshly roasted organic coffee, retro-styled ice cream parlours, film screenings on the sand, pop-up restaurants and kiosks of select magazines and newspapers, the new brand is a result of a year-long revamp of the former Naiad resorts. Children's illustrator Quentin Blake has won this year's Prince Philip Designers Prize presented by the Duke of Edinburgh. The UK's longest-running design award has recognised designers' contributions to daily life for over half a century. This year, the Design Council has commissioned a book of original artwork from previous participants, including Sir Terence Conran, Vivienne Westwood and Sir Paul Smith. And finally, a new natural history museum in Utah brings a whole new meaning to getting to grips with nature. The Salt Lake City Museum on the University of Utah campus invites visitors to touch artifacts, walk across fossil dig sites and interact with exhibits. The striking $100 million building, designed by Enniad architects to blend into the high foothills of the Wasatch Mountain Range, is covered in gleaming copper panels donated by the Rio Tinto Mining Company.
Thank you very much, Hazel, and welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. As if you needed any persuasion to fly from the chilly northern hemisphere to Miami at this time of year, Design Miami is more reason to go than ever. Now in its seventh year, the week-long event sees the design collectors of the world descend on the East Coast city for a riot of shows, talks, business and parties. It's a sight to behold, and you don't have to be a gallerist or a collector to get in on the action. We send our reporter, Sammy Mack, to give us the skinny on this year's event.
The first design you notice at Design Miami is actually outside the exhibition tent. It's a 10-foot wooden cube with an egg-shaped space resected from the box, creating oval portals that open to the bright blue Miami sky. This is Genesis, the site-specific installation by designer of the year David Ajay. Ajay is a London-based architect who was born in Tanzania. Before they even go inside the exhibition space, visitors to Design Miami climb and lean and sit on Ajay's Genesis installation. It's interactive, complicated, simultaneously organic and mathematical, exquisitely executed. Genesis sets the tone for Design Miami.
I think it's the only fair dedicated to collectible design, meaning to very rare objects of the past or experimental design fresh out of the laboratories of today.
Marianne Goebel is director of Design Miami. Design Miami is in its seventh year, 50% bigger than it was last year, with nearly 30 galleries showing collections inside the tent that we now sit in. This is the second year Design Miami's been on Miami Beach, directly across the street from its sister fair, Art Basel.
If you are already a design expert or you're a design virgin, you can really discover very interesting and beautiful and compelling things. So you can learn and you can simply have a good time.
Mariana Rodriguez Iglesias is one of those visitors having a very good time.
And I think this is art nowadays.
She's just walked through a performance exhibit sponsored by Fendi. Using scrap leather, artists Elisa Strozek and Sebastian Nieb have been constructing strange, sagging pieces of furniture.
Como sueños, es magia, ¿no? Es un sueño o surrealismo.
Like dreams, Rodriguez Iglesias says, magic, surrealism. Rodriguez Iglesias is a curator from Buenos Aires, Argentina. She says she found Art Basel across the street to be colder than she expected, more commercial. Here it's more moderate, more thoughtful. There's order. One of those expertly ordered spaces at Design Miami is Gallery Seomi from Korea. The organic designs and materials here have a decidedly marine feel. A walnut wood bench from Sewa Bay is steam-bent into the undulating lines of a wave about to crest. Then there are Huncheong Lee's ceramic stools, like oversized coral polyps with ocean turquoise glazes. Gallerist PJ Park and I sit down on two of those stools and talk about what Design Miami means to Korean designers.
Korea, in a way, has lost or never had a contemporary design scene. After the war in the 50s, everything was torn down, and then mostly it was imported. So what you see here are contemporary Korean designers who are actually believing that Korean contemporary design is very important, and that it's something that we need in our history.
Park, who is drinking a small cup of Cuban coffee, says he thinks about place when preparing for Design Miami.
Because we're in Miami, I bring what I think will fit into Miami. Of course, the weather is so nice. It's always sun. So we bring outdoor furniture and designs.
Park is not the only one thinking about light. Light is definitely a focus of this year's show.
Lighting is the one thing that we find the least of and sell the most of.
Evan Snyderman of our 20th Century Gallery says this as he sits underneath three light sculptures by Jeff Zimmerman. The lights defy gravity the way they grow out of the ceiling and wall, like the reaching tendrils of vines.
The lighting has so much influence on everything around it. There's no other piece of furniture that does that.
Then there's the light installation by Random International at Carpenter's Workshop Gallery. It's a panel of square, mirrored light bulbs that glow in an amoeba-like outline of the person standing before it. The effect is sort of a reverse silhouette. Gallerist Loic Legaillard of Carpenter's Workshop.
Contemporary designer will work with the mediums and the techniques of their generation, and interaction is of course something which is extremely contemporary.
Like other gallerists this week, Legaillard says business is good.
The Museum of Art and Design in New York has actually purchased this Double Buffet Nouvelle-Zélande from Vincent Dubourg.
As much as Design Miami is a showcase for global designers, it also functions as a space for hobnobbing and catching up. Glasses of champagne are as fashionable as black pants around here. The scent of perfume and alcohol swirls through the crowds.
People are definitely laid back. It's different than Switzerland.
Paul Johnson of Johnson Trading Gallery.
We're showing Guangzhou Li, Max Lam, Ricky Clifton, and Rafael de Cardenas. They're all very different designers, but they kind of have the same kind of language because everything's kind of made by hand.
He says he likes what he's seen here so far this year.
Some of the American galleries here are showing like Frank Lloyd Wright, and the show's never had that. It's been like highly European vintage.
Aside from Frank Lloyd Wright, some of the vintage pieces getting noticed here are Privé tables and Ron Arad's concrete stereo. But not everyone at Design Miami is sold on the vintage contemporary designs. Over at Moss Gallery, a crowd gathers around a series of white, laser-cut steel bowls. They look like magnified tissue samples. A sign on the wall describes artist and Dr. Haresh Lalvani as a morphologist. I asked gallerist Franklin Getchell to explain.
What is a morphologist? A morphologist, I think anyone can be a morphologist. It's, you are a morphologist, aren't you?
What makes me a morphologist?
Saying you are one. Now, it's a term I think that Haresh uses to describe his work because he is focused so much on the changing.
On the subject of change, Getchell, who has been coming to Design Miami since Design Miami was new, says the fair has evolved.
This fair used to be about contemporary design, which was quite interesting and groundbreaking. And so now coming here is coming to a totally different kind of fair for us. It's not that it's a bad fair, it's just not what it was when we started coming. We liked it the way it was, and they should have left it alone. But
says the man who's showing the morphology exhibit.
So, oh yeah, good point.
One of the designers bringing new techniques to the fair this year is Tom Price. His Meltdown series for Industry Gallery is a set of chairs made from plastic objects. This is Price's first time at Design Miami. He says he's impressed by what he's seen. He's also been impressed by the weather.
It's great. Hey, I've just come from London, and it's about 1 degree, and it's cold, and it's raining, and it's windy, and I just strolled down Miami Beach to work today, and it's not a bad place to be.
Back outside the tent, it's turned into an only in Miami kind of night. The air is salty, with just a whisper of a breeze coming off the ocean. Ajay's wooden Genesis sculpture smells like a timber yard. One of the visitors sitting on the edge of the box is Columbia-born Miami architect Claudia Ospina. For Ospina, the best contemporary design is a self-fulfilling achievement.
If you believe in what you design, it's always going to be there, no matter how hard times are. And whoever appreciates art, they're always going to recognize what is valuable and what is worth. And it's, when it comes to art, nobody stops art because art is infinite. It won't stop.
By those standards, Design Miami has a bright future.
That was Monocle reporter Sammy Mack at Design Miami. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment to hear more from Marianne Goebel, the fair's new design director. Every good fair needs a good captain at its helm. And Design Miami this year has a new one. Marianne Goebel stepped in to take over from the fair's founder, Ambra Medda, earlier this year. Goebel has a very strong pedigree in the design world. She cut her teeth at Vitra as the head of international press and partnerships. I spoke to Marianne, rather unfairly, the morning after Design Miami's opening night, to hear what she hoped she'd bring to the Design Miami brand. So, Marianne, thank you very much for joining us. I'm wondering, this is your first year as the director of Design Miami, and obviously Ambra Medda, who was the founding director, did a fantastic job building it into a globally renowned brand. But what have you brought to it that's different?
I think, as you said, Ambra had done an amazing job to put something on a map in a very short period of time, which just hadn't existed before. And I now have the privilege, after taking over after 6 years, maybe to rather concentrate on, let's say, fine-tuning.
Right.
Rather than revolutionizing things.
Okay.
So I think that for this first year, what retrospectively was important to me, I had to realize that there's really a lot of, that we're still on an educational mission, in the sense that design still, by many people, is not perceived as a creative discipline in its own right, which I am personally convinced of that it is, and it's even a very important one. So being on this educational mission, for me, was very important to reinforce the historical program while obviously working at the same time with the contemporary galleries to push them to work on specific commissions, on new work to be unveiled and to debut at the fair.
And Marianne, tell me, you speak a little bit about the confusion in many people's eyes of what design is and where it sits. And, I mean, this is sort of no more so apparent than in the design art world, which, particularly with Design Miami sitting next to Art Basel, is there a tension between the sort of art and design elements of the fairs?
I wouldn't call it a tension. I would rather say there is actually a really, there's more like a fruitful exchange. But mm-hmm. our fair is clearly dedicated to design in the sense of the functional object. It's about furniture, lighting, objets d'art, but which are not just decorative, but also fulfill a purpose.
Of course, and I mean the pieces on show for people who aren't aware tend to be sort of at the high end of the price range, which many people in the past have said, you know, is it really feasible to pay a huge sum of money for something that is functional? You know, would you sit on a chair that you've paid £10,000 for? I mean, you've come from, before being the director of Design Miami, from being a very huge part of Vitra, which is one of the world's foremost manufacturers of functional furniture. Do you see all the designs from the galleries at Design Miami as primarily functional objects, not as artworks?
Yes, I do. And I think it's very, especially with my background, it's very interesting to look at these questions. And I think if you look at art, there's only autonomous art. If you look at design, it's a really broad spectrum. It starts at the mass-produced, machine-made series and goes to the unique handmade object. And obviously, Design Miami is more focusing on the leather part of the spectrum. But if you look at what is being presented at Design Miami, you have on the one hand the historic work, which are gems from the past, which were maybe unique site-specific private commissions, or which were early prototypes of work which was supposed to go into serial production, which maybe never went into serial production, or it's pieces which actually have gone into serial production, but only very few pieces remained. I think that's the, if you look at the historic element. And then if you look at the contemporary element, this is also something we had, I've also experienced at Vitra, developing a design project is a very complex process which can take many years and which has to meet many norms and restrictions. And due to this complex project, great ideas are often just dropped at a very early stage because it's clear from the beginning that this can never be translated into a serial production. And I think that's exactly where the galleries come into play, which are represented at Design Miami. These are in a way like mini enterprises which enable these designers to pursue experiments and realize ideas that could never work on a large scale.
How interesting. So it's sort of a bit like an encyclopedia of sort of the progress of design, not just looking at the things that finally come out of the manufacturer, but the things that went into sort of building the ideas along the way as well.
Yeah, and often if you look now at seminal pieces of design history, they never went into serial production because it was just not possible to realize them, or they only go into serial production now. Like, I don't want to start to bore you with the theme stories, but like...
No, don't worry, I'm more than familiar with quite a few of them. But tell me, this year there are 28 galleries from around the world exhibiting, and that's, am I right in saying that's 50% more than in last year?
Yeah, 40% more. We have 29 presentations. Last year we were at 20, so yeah, and we're still... small, but
that's a huge
small.
Rise. Why is it so many more this year?
Well, I think we have to be realistic. And in the American market in 2008 and 2009 was really strongly hit by the financial crisis, which had not happened as much in the European market. So already last year, it was really like taking off again. And also last year was the first year that Design Miami had moved to Miami Beach. And this turned out a very successful move, so we could continue the growth from last year to this year.
That was Design Miami director Marianne Goebel. Every fair has a soundtrack that goes with it, the songs that you hear again and again over the course of the week. In Miami this week, it was local synth-pop duo ANR, and this is our favourite track from their latest album, Here's Holes. That was Holes by homegrown Miami group ANR, which stands for Awesome New Republic. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Stay with us for some more awesomeness all the way from Miami, coming up after this.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
Welcome back to Design Miami-themed Section D here on Monocle 24. After 7 years, Design Miami has left its mark on its host city, cultivating a new energy in retail, architecture and design, with more permanent roots than the fleeting week of the fair itself. From a rash of luxury fashion outlets to some of the more daring architecture in the US, we dispatched our reporter, Kerry McKernan, to get to grips with Miami's design district and find out what it's all about.
In the lobby of the iconic Eden Rock Hotel, there's a large collage made of paint, old newspapers, and ephemera from the Art Deco days. The painting reads, "Nothing happens unless first a dream." Art Deco hotels along the breezy Atlantic have come back to life with expensive restorations. And it all started with one man's dream. Welcome to the Miami Design District. The dreamer, Mr. Craig Robbins, real estate developer turned lifestyle, brand, culture shaper.
When I eventually came down here and I met Craig and sort of started to understand a little bit more about what was happening here, I very much liked the way that he was really curating the area itself, and it wasn't a mass scramble to fill spaces with whatever, you know, people were willing to come and open stores here. He was very, very particular about how he did this and who he let be here, which I think is important because especially in the States, it becomes very easy for somewhere like this to too rapidly become almost like a mall where it's just every single standard brand you've seen with a Starbucks next to a Gap, next to a Ralph Lauren.
That's London-born fashion designer Duncan Quinn. He's chatting with me in his men's atelier over a long, rustically elegant wooden dining table filled with last night's wine glasses. Robbins calls the design district Miami's laboratory for creativity. He uses words like community, neighborhood, and permanence, while at the same time creating temporary events during which something special happens. South Florida on the whole was saturated with vacant luxury apartment homes and lavish empty offices built by get-rich-quick developers during the condo boom. Along with them came a tsunami of land speculators who had no long-term commitment to the area. They hoped to amass fortunes with the build-and-flip model of real estate investment. Robbins' model is quite different and thriving. Giampiero De Persia is the partner in the Poltrano Frau Design Showroom. We're in their showroom in the Design District. Many elite design retailers have opened, favoring the Design District over the historic and more established neighborhood of Coral Gables. I asked De Persia if what's happening here could happen in other cities.
Miami has something in common with the city that, some of the city that you mentioned, like London. Miami is the quintessential of the melting pot. There is a mix of cultures, a lot of Europeans, a tremendous number of Latin American from different countries with different cultures as well. And they all blend together and are creating this vibe that allow this, what I would like to call an international culture. In New York, the design district could be compared with Soho 20 years ago. It could have happened in Chicago. I don't think so. So Miami has a special atmosphere, and of course the climate helps a lot.
Gallery owner and curator Rosa de la Cruz's family originally hails from Cuba. She says Miami is her home. She conducts a tour of her collection to a group from the Philadelphia Museum of Art, strolling through a large installation of colored mirrors in wooden frames.
Each mirror is a different color. So when you walk through it, you see yourself. And of course, as narcissists as we are, we always look at mirrors. No, and we see each other in different colors. And it's placed on top of the local newspaper. Here, it's on top of the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald, being Miami a bilingual city.
Robbins dreamed of neighborhoods and commerce coming together through the arts in permanent and temporary ways. He aims to create meaningful partnerships and lasting impressions. The Design District is now known for pushing boundaries. It's created a unique relationship between artist and consumer, pushing them closer together.
That was Monocle reporter Kerry McKiernan dissecting Miami's Design District. Time for a short break, but coming up next, we're back in Europe, in Milan, to delve into the favourite things of one of my favourite gallerists, Nina Yashar. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Now, if you've never been to Niloufar Gallery on Via della Spiga in Milan, then you've a treat in store on your next trip. Presided over by the effervescent collector Nina Yashar, Niloufar is a maze of rooms showcasing an intriguing mix of design, old and new, found and commissioned. With such an expert eye, we thought it fitting to sit down with Nina and quiz her on the pieces she singles out as shaping her life and career. These are Nina Yashar's favourite things.
Galleria Niloufar, buongiorno.
Yes, hello, I'm here to see Nina Yashar.
Yes, please.
Good afternoon, Nina. It's great that you could have us today. I always find your gallery, Niloufar, to be a fabulous breath of fresh air here in Via della Spiga.
Yes, actually, Niloufar Gallery is in a street who is mainly dedicated in fashion stores, where the principal attention is connected in the what will be the next color in fashion. And here we are the only gallery in that street who doesn't deal fashion. And principally, we like really, it's refreshing also for the people. They can see like a little island in the middle of these stores who deals historical design, contemporary design, and also we like very much to do synergy of different cultures and different period and different geographical area.
Let's take a look at what is in your window display right now. These look like, again, it looks like you're on a flower theme now. These are chandeliers. They look like various flower stems pointing up with light bulbs on them. Who is this piece by?
These are four chandeliers of Carlo Scarpa, 1948, in the golden age of Venini. And they are four unique pieces, so we can say they are museum pieces. And they were done for a whole entrance of an hotel, Hotel Turin in Turin, and they have gold inclusion, gold leaf inclusion inside the glass, and they are really four masterpieces.
How did you come across these?
Some dealers they showed me and I bought them very quickly, even if they are very important and expensive, through a picture, because I immediately felt the importance of these pieces.
So you have several rooms here, I see. It's like a labyrinth.
Yes, now we are entering in the other space. We have in the opposite side of the building. And we have a courtyard in between of the two spaces, actually. And now this is a sort of little warehouse.
It's very cute for a warehouse. I would love to have a warehouse like this in my house. So what little gems do we have here that are particularly close to your heart?
So here we have this collection of Laura Bethan Wood that she was actually the student of Martino Gamper. He introduced me her. And I launched her, and she works exclusively for my gallery. I launched her with this incredible process of laminate marquetry. It means that she does these amazing coffee tables.
There are these low tables here that I see.
Yeah, exactly, where you can see different layers of laminated of formica, different colors of formica, laser cut
Laser cut, wow.
Yeah, and then assembled by hand is a very incredible. We make the comparison with 17th Italian century marquetry.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like the Louis says furniture. I think this is the reinterpretation of our century with a very total different material, that it's the formica, and they were used super important woods. And she used this, and she does like a sort of marquetry, as you can see.
What other trees do we have in this stock room? This it's like a Wunderkammer for me, just looking around.
So what they really, we have these two yellow library of Andrea Branzi that we presented on last April at the Salone del Mobile. And they are so incredible because of the color. And I am quite surprised that also to my most traditional and bourgeois customers I have, they like this kind of color, the so strong yellow. And I think it's very interesting how people, they are changing their taste also.
What would you describe, how would you describe your design aesthetic, if you had to put it into a phrase?
It's quite difficult to say because, as I told you before, I like to follow the aesthetic of the planet in a way. So, as I told you before, I think now the minimalism is not anymore so appreciated. So my principal idea is always to make unexpected combination of pieces.
So none of the all white.
No, I don't like white cubes, actually.
It's a bit cold, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. People at the end, they don't want to live in a cold rooms or apartment.
Well, Nina, thank you so much for having us today. It's been a great fun going on the tour of your gallery. Thanks again.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That was Nina Yashar of Niljafar Gallery in Milan with our correspondent Ivan Carvalho. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Section D. Now, auction house Phillips de Puri each year hosts its Design Masters auction in New York. It's a year in the making, bringing together single or extremely limited edition designs, some of which have been lost to history. It's not just about expensive lots. The Design Masters auction is an episode in the chapter of the story of design each year. All eyes in the industry fall on New York come the 13th of December when the sale takes place. I sat down earlier with Alexander Payne, design director of Phillips de Puri, to hear how it comes together. Alexander, you've got your most sort of significant annual auction coming up in New York on the 13th of December, is that right?
Absolutely. It's a year in creation. Each year we embark on creating and bringing together the world's finest pieces. It's a long journey, but it's an exciting one. And it's a survey that we really want to always offer and present the most diverse and exciting design.
And you spend a year trawling the world for sort of one-off outstanding pieces.
Absolutely. The important thing for this sale is always looking at the provenance and the exhibition history of where these pieces have come from and the importance to the market.
It sounds like a fantastic job. I'd love to do something like that myself. But I've got a catalogue here, which I've been flicking through over the past few days and have picked out some extraordinary pieces. The first of which is a Georges Chevalier chandelier from Baccarat. And I mean, you said just then that it's all about the provenance. Tell us a little bit about this.
Exactly. From the seminal 1925 Expositional International des Arts Décoratifs and Industrial Moderne, this is one of the most important moments in the 1920s where the fabulous Art Deco movement was presented and highlighted to the world. This piece by Chevalier, incredibly important. This is the only second time that it's really been seen by the market. It was originally purchased once. It was exhibited in the Baccarat Chandelier by an Australian visiting the World's Fair, visiting the fair, and they took it to Sydney to a theatre from where it stood from 28 to the 80s.
Gosh. And how do you come to discover a piece like this? Is it a lot of research and thinking, gosh, haven't seen that for a long time. I wonder who's got that tucked away in their warehouse.
Yeah, both that and also this sale draws, we're very fortunate, a lot of exciting property to us that people are very interested about the sale and what's in it, and they're wanting to be part of the sale. For this auction, we wanted a great focus on the Art Deco period. We have works by Dunant, by Rorman, these kind of titans of the Art Deco movement. And the Chevalier Baccarat piece has tied the entire cell together. It's such a wonderful work.
It's absolutely huge and so beautiful. I was saying to you earlier that it's really one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen from Baccarat.
Well, it really lives up to its name, being this jet of water and this beautiful cascading crystals creating this absolutely sensational light. And you can imagine it in the 1920s.
Definitely.
Being an absolute gem.
I have to say that I'm surprised that the estimate is $200,000 to $250,000, which is obviously a lot of money, but for such a rare historic piece, I would have expected it to be much higher.
Of course. A very difficult object to price, something that obviously dictated an important estimate and certainly is going to be attractive to many collectors. But there is really no precedent to a piece like this. It's a very, very rare piece to find. It is significantly large, and you know, it is an enormous undertaking by any collector to house a chandelier.
How much does it weigh?
It weighs just shy of, I think, half a ton. So this is a quarter of a ton. So this is a huge, huge undertaking.
You can't just have it in your front hall.
No, there's a little bit of structural engineering that needs to happen before you make the commitment. But quite a unique object.
Moving on. In the catalogue, there are some other familiar names. We've got this incredible George Nakashima bench, which, I mean, that is absolutely stunning.
Well, what drew us to this, again, we wanted to bring an exceptional work to the market and to collectors. The conoid bench with an arm is very, very unusual, very rare. It's the first example I've ever actually handled with this beautiful freeform side. And also this lovely figured side where you have the spindles to one side of the bench, you have this lovely arm to the right-hand side of the spindles, and then where the spindle back stops, you have this lovely free-formed edge with these beautiful signature Nakashima key details. So both its scale, the rarity of the arm, and the very much this kind of elaborate free-form base makes it an exceptional example.
And then finally, I wanted to talk to you about some of the contemporary design that you have. There's this Studio Yobe table with, it's called Perished, and it's got incredible marquetry of bones of reptiles.
Absolutely.
Laid into it, all over it. But what is it that sits these designers who are actually very young, in amongst all of these very classic, historic, significant pieces?
Absolutely. Well, with the auctions that we do, I like to make these connections, and my team and I always work with creating tension and connections within the 20th and 21st century. So in the cell, we have some exquisite work by Jean Dunant, obviously a 1930s Art Deco designer using eggshell, crackle lacquer. And we wanted to see how that tradition had translated into the 21st century. So looking at marquetry today and what a contemporary design duo such as Studio Yobe is doing was for us a very interesting connection to make.
And maybe you could tell us a little bit about what the auction feels like. I mean, you work on this for the whole year, and then it all comes together on one night in New York.
Absolutely.
It must be an enormous spectacle. Is it terrifying?
It certainly keeps us at the edge of our seats. It's an exciting moment. It's a thrilling moment. But as you say, you work and catalogue, and I have a sensational team of cataloguers and members of my team. We all work beautifully together. And this is all part of a huge labour of love, with all of us working both on the research of the works, the photographing of the works. And as you say, the exhibition is the next great step of installing and presenting these works to the market. And then, as you say, in the blink of an eye, in a couple of hours, the whole sale is over after 12 months' work.
And then you go and get very drunk afterwards, I hope.
it's more exhaustion, I think. And suddenly, yes, we will return from where we came and begin again.
That was Alexander Payne of Phillips de Puri with me in the studio earlier. Time now to head upstairs and hear once again from Poppy Shibamoto, Monocle's photo director. This week, she takes us through her favourite fruit, the yuzu.
Yuzu is a citrus fruit that is mainly produced in Japan and China. The fruit size can vary from that of a plum to as big as a small melon. Its skin has many small dimples, and you will find more than enough pips within. Yuzu is bitter and tangy and full of a unique fragrance. A squeeze of yuzu juice is added as an accent to a dressing, and its zest adds depth to cakes and sauces. It has an earthier flavour than that of a lemon or lime, but like its cousins, it is often used as a kick to a cocktail. The yuzu tree starts to bear fruit in August and September. Although they'll still look green, when they ripen in December, their skin will have turned a deep yellow colour, somewhat darker than lemons. My favourite way to enjoy yuzu is with my whole body. Immersing myself into a hot bath, the water infused with yuzu. Take 5 to 6 yuzu cut into halves and score the skin. Tie them up in a linen bag and dip it in the hot bath. Once you are in the bath, squeeze the bag to get more juice out of the fruit to tailor the infusion to your liking. Your skin will be softer and shinier, and you will feel ever so warm for the next few hours that follow your bath. This is the best way to enjoy the refreshing natural fragrance of yuzu on your skin, and will help you to prepare for a long winter. It also improves circulation, helps with a hangover, muscular pain, fatigue, and renew the keratin within your skin to keep it moist. Bathhouses and onsens in Japanese ryokan usually do a special yuzu hot bath service on the 21st or 22nd of December, which is the longest night in the year. Some animals, like a capybara, even get to go in the yuzu hot tubs in Japanese zoos during the winter solstice. It's nice to think in a yuzu bath that the days will get longer and longer, and the nights shorter, from the next day onwards.
That was Poppy Shibamoto, talking us through the yuzu and what she likes to do with it. Next up, it's our global shopping spree, and this week we're heading back in time to our favourite vintage furniture stores. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Section D on Monocle 24. Second-hand furniture shopping has seen a dramatic rise, thanks in no small part to the ease of browsing online and the competitive bargains you find there. But far from cannibalising the physical retail of second-hand furniture, beautifully decked-out vintage furniture shops have reaped the benefit of greater knowledge in a growing consumer market. We headed to LA, London and Paris to hear from three of our favourite retailers what's flying off their shelves.
I'm Tama Ray, and I am the owner-operator of Tama's Magic Mercantile in the high desert of Yucca Valley, California. My shop is entered into its 11th year, and it's a mall. We have vendors and antique dealers of every description you can imagine. We have about 35 individuals at this time. It's amazing how much popularity there is in the modern mid-century furnishings and decor. That would be rugs, lamps, tables. That's what our most requested item is. The sofa that we're sitting on and the coffee table in front of it are Danish modern, and Danish modern is pretty much the epitome of mid-century modern. Most desirable because they're made very, very well. They hold up over the years. For instance, this very incredible sofa that we're sitting on is only $400. In Los Angeles, if you could find one in this condition at all, it would probably be $1,200 to $1,500 and considered a bargain. These type of items don't last very long, maybe a week or two. When people come into the shop, if they have an idea of what they're looking for, we usually have it in that there's 10,000 square feet here to browse. The first thing that they'll see is some local art, some nice Native American pottery, basketry, and rugs. We have a beautiful showcase of vintage jewelry, followed by some vintage glass, the Higgins glass, very popular in the 50s and 60s. the way this is set up, there's vignettes. Each dealer or vendor has their rented space, and they each have their own unique style and taste. And therefore, you can walk into a mid-century modern vignette. You can go into a vignette of what I call snooty decor, where it's just all big chunky furniture, like for huge homes. And the desert is a very unique place when it comes to decorating homes and yards. We don't have lawns. We don't have trees. We have the desert. And so it creates a whole different venue for desert dwellers.
My name is Nina Hertig. I'm the co-founder of Sigmar on Kings Road in London. We sell a mix of pieces. It's more an aesthetic and an idea than it is a specific designer or era or material. We like things that are beautifully made and things that are perhaps a little bit quiet, not the loudest, not the brightest pieces you've ever seen, but things that are classic in the way that they were conceived and also classic in the way they were executed. And to us, that means quality in everything and things that feel good. I think that when times are tough, people look to classicism again. They want things that they feel comfortable with and things that they feel they can keep for a long time, which is great news for us because it's what we truly believe in our hearts of heart. So we do a lot of natural materials such as wood and leather and things that you can't get today, so things that you can't possibly go and buy a new version of, but you can have an old one which has a story, it has a patina, it has something to add to your house. We do a variety of pieces. Obviously, you know, things change all the time, we get new pieces in almost on a daily basis. But we do a lot of Austrian pieces by a designer called Karl Auberg, who also had his own little workshop where he made most of his things. They do very well for us. They're very much what we believe in. It can be anything you want. He has a back catalogue of 4,500 pieces, so we're constantly surprised. Our clients are constantly surprised at what comes out. And it could be things like this beautiful little coin tray that we have, which is made from turned wood, and with a little handle, just made in solid brass and wrapped in it's a paper cord, really, and it's just absolutely beautifully done. And when you take these very simple materials, they become bigger than the materials themselves and create something that a lot of people love, and so do we. We've somebody commented recently and said, I can't tell what's new and what's vintage, and that made us very happy. That means we're doing something right. It's supposed to be a story that started a long time ago and hasn't finished yet. So if we can make everything fit into that story and not differentiate between what is old and what is new, we're very happy.
I'm Alexander from the store Kitty Watch, Espace Kitty Watch in Paris. It's Rue Tiquetonne, it's next to the Quartier Montorgueil. We're specialized in secondhand. We have a warehouse back in Rouen, in the north of France, and we distribute from all over the world. And the thing is over here, is the best secondhand that we could find comes first to our store. And then since we've grown, like the store grew up back in 1998, so now it's 550 square meters. Now we also have new collections. We have 80 different brands of new collections. And we also have inside of the store three corners, which are a corner for the shoes, ladies and men's, new collections, and we also have sunglasses. And there is a corner also that sells old watches and new collections of watches also. Our philosophy is the street philosophy, as what we think it is, you know, is when people wear like stuff, since we are from secondhand, the philosophy is just like to be who you are and that's it, you know, and that's what we observe. It's like when you're wearing something, you're not just wearing just like one type or one brand, and especially in secondhand, because when it used to be before, the big shops came, or the big Zara or H&M. It used to be like lots cheaper, you know, in secondhand. That's our philosophy. That's the base of the philosophy. And then being and trying to find the stuff for people out on the street and wearing what they want is what we're trying to propose to them for their style.
What are you selling especially at the moment?
Well, with the cold coming in, you know, it's going to be like big pieces. So it's going to be mouton retourné, big sweaters also for the men and for the women. Lots of furs for the ladies. We got leather shorts. We got tons of stuff. You know, we got over 18,000 pieces of secondhand clothes. maybe 21,000. And we have about like 18,000 pieces of new collection clothes. So it's quite a lot.
And I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this week on Section D. But fear not, we'll be back next Tuesday the 13th, and next week we're going Dutch. No, that's not asking you to split the production cost. We're heading to the Netherlands to see how the peculiarly small nation has carved out a design industry to rival the very best. Be sure to tune in for that. And thank you for tuning into this. Today's show was produced by Gillian DeBias, researched by Thea Erdahl and Hazel Pfeiffer, and I'm Hugo MacDonald. Goodbye.